You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Harvard Law professor Lonnie Guinier on her book, Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Also on the program today, more out of the Obama administration budget, extension of Social Security benefits to same-sex couples, an attempt to negotiate for drug prices under Medicare D. Also on the program today, Chris Christie, buddies with the King of Jordan. What are you going to do about it? And more on the concern over the potential for a measles epidemic in this country. Oil workers on strike. And more, ladies and gentlemen. Just a couple of housekeeping points. We got a great email from a listener that I'm going to read later in the program. But it's always gratifying to see people. We got a lot of great responses on the Yohan Hari interview. And I'm going to read one of them. But there was a couple of really great responses to that interview. People who have dealt with drug addiction in their own family. But before we get there, I want to just remind you, we still have a couple more days in which we can be nominated for a podcast award. You head over to podcastawards.com and nominate us for Best Political and News Podcast and also People's Choice. Starting 3 days from now, I believe it is. Maybe it'll be next Monday. We will ask you to vote. And I think you're able to vote. If they do it the same way they did last year, you can vote every day, once a day. Nominations end on the 6th. And then voting will start. So you got like 3 days left to nominate us if you haven't already. And then voting starts, and we will ask you to do that on a regular basis. Also, give us a review on iTunes. iTunes is the only game in town when it comes to disseminating. I mean, obviously on Android, there's a myriad of different podcast players that you can use. But iTunes is really the only chart that exists out there in terms of popularity of podcasts. And it gets us in front of more eyes when you give us a review, when you rate us. And so that is extremely helpful. So if you have the opportunity to do that, please do. And of course, as always, becoming a member of the Majority Report helps keep this show alive day in, day out at jointhemajorityreport.com. We're going to get to the Chris Christie. I just love this story, though. $30,000 stay in a luxury hotel for a weekend in Israel, and it was paid for by the King of Jordan.
The King of Jordan is a personal friend, and if you can't accept that, then shut up.
There you go.
Shut up.
I love it.
I'm an incredibly corrupt and unethical human being, and if you can't deal with that, then shut up.
And to be fair, like I said on Twitter, it's quite possible the King of Jordan is also handling part of New Jersey's pension fund. So in that case, it makes it all right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Lonnie Guinier about the tyranny of the meritocracy. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome Professor of Law at Harvard University, or Professor Lonnie Guinier, author of Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. I understand you guys have about 4 feet of snow there. My folks are still in Worcester, and so I've heard all about it.
Well, we fortunately don't have 4 feet, but we're close.
Pretty close. All right. Well, let's talk about your book, the Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Let's just start with the notion of ostensibly, and you made the point in your book that the term meritocracy was first, I guess, coined in a satirical way, but I mean, what is the meritocracy supposed to do?
Well, the meritocracy, at least in the United States, is not necessarily supposed to do something. It's measured by what it can do, and the measurement is the ability to do well on certain kinds of tests that are presumed to predict one's ability to contribute to the larger society. The problem is that the focus is on competitive individualism, and performance on these tests doesn't really predict who's going to work well in the context of a democracy or in the context of an organization. Who's going to do well just because they got really good test scores when they were applying to college. That doesn't predict how well they're going to do in the real world when they're trying to solve complex problems.
And in fact, I mean, when we talk about the admission process to higher education, when we talk about the SAT scores, they more closely correlate to income and, I guess, what you could call loosely social capital than they do future success.
Yes, that has been shown by a number of scholars, including evidence that the test score is better able to predict what kind of car your parents drive rather than what kind of human being you're going to be in a democracy in the 21st century.
And so, I mean, ultimately, when you talk about democratic merit and testocratic merit, I mean, lay out for us specifically what the difference is so that we can contrast those two.
Well, democratic merit is a concept that I've just put together, trying to connect the value of people who can contribute to the enjoyment and the productivity of a democracy. Testocratic merit basically tells us how well somebody does on a particular paper and pencil test, but doesn't predict whether that person is going to contribute to the larger society or to contribute to a democracy. So the testocratic merit is really just, it's turned out to be more of a wealth test than a democracy-enhancing test.
And, I mean, do you think that is, to what extent is that by, I guess, to what extent is that a function of, well, that we just made a poor choice in the way that we're going to dole out admissions? And to what extent is that sort of a feature as opposed to a bug, as they say?
I'm not really sure I understand
the idea being, to what extent is these type of test takings constructed as a way of maintaining a social dynamic? In other words, you know, it's one thing to say that, I mean, you're arguing that we should be using a mechanism to measure the value of someone in terms of whether or not they get into a higher education based on certain on certain outcomes. To what extent do we have this testocracy because there is a desire by those who control these institutions at its, you know, its sort of most broadest level to maintain the social outcomes that we have?
Well, I think it's correct in concluding that the testocracy tells us more about the current wealth of the person taking the test than it does of the potential contribution that this person has the capacity of making to the larger society. So it's a kind of testocratic merit that because of the ways that the SAT or the ACT are normed as well as scored, the people who do better on those tests are the people who can prepare for the test. And to prepare for the test, you have to have money to pay for the person who's going to teach you how to take the test. So we're stuck in a system that's preoccupied with who's going to do well on a particular test as a catalyst or as a stand-in for who's going to contribute to the larger society. And my argument is that if we really want to contribute to the larger society, we have to learn how to work together. We have to learn how to collaborate. We have to learn how to problem solve. And that's much more important in terms of emphasizing the power of our working together and not getting focused primarily on who's the smartest, but on how can we create problem-solving groups that can actually help us come up with solutions. And so that's the long-term goal. But the short-term goal has to do with how do you teach people or how do you get people to feel confident about their understanding of material. And one of the most important elements, I think, of the Tyranny of the Meritocracy book is the stories about Eric Mazur, who's a professor of physics at Harvard, and who discovered that his students are better at teaching each other than he is necessarily at teaching the whole class. That is, there's a strong correlation between people being able to work together, to collaborate, to solve problems, that predicts performance and contribution, as opposed to tests that just tell us who's really good at taking this test.
And do you think that, I mean, you know, the SAT regime and the testocracy it seems to me, has been a regime, and I would include the sort of the testocracy that we see in the context now, even in elementary school and in high schools and whatnot, that this regime has sort of strengthened and become even more, I guess, relevant as a means in which to get promoted within society. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on whether or not the reason why it has sort of increased in its, permeating these different elements of society, particularly through education, has been a function because it has served to maintain the status quo on some level, that it rewards people who are just like those people who have been in charge of imposing the testocracy?
Well, I think that's a fair statement, and I can also state that when I was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, I was given access by the dean to 4 years of student performance, and I got their LSAT scores, their undergraduate GPA, I got their law school grades, and what I found is that the LSAT was just a very weak predictor of who was going to do well in law school, and yet it's considered to be a measure of talent, when in fact it's a measure of how well endowed your parents are or you are so that you can practice and learn how to take a particular test that turns out not to predict very much.
And so I guess, you know, so when you present that information to the dean of that law school, what is the response at that point?
The response at that point is to move on to some other subject.
Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. I mean, what is behind that? Is it simply, well, you know, we just don't have the time to really get into something that is more predictive? Or is it this is the way that we maintain our ratings? Or is that all of those things plus the fact that we don't get complaints from the people who either fund our endowment at the larger university because of this system, because it ends up rewarding their kids, their friends' kids?
Well, I think there's an element of each of your models. But I think the key point is that the LSAT is just misunderstood. People just assume that the LSAT is predictive of performance in law school, and that's a presumption that, in fact, is not true. I mean, it's true in a very little way. And it also is validated or is attractive because the people who learn to do well on this test are the people who have access to wealth and thus are the people who can then afford to pay to go to law school.
Right. I mean, it functions as a gatekeeper as much as something that's supposed to be predictive.
Yes. A gatekeeper is a good metaphor.
And you state that you have a similar issue with the way that we have developed affirmative action in this country.
Well, I think those two issues are a little bit different, but I do think that the question of class has to be included in the discussion of access to higher education. And by class, I mean we need to reach out to poor and working class whites and poor and working class blacks, not just to reach out to people based on the color of their skin.
I mean, so I wonder, you know, there have been some, and this is a slightly off topic from the book, but there have been recent Supreme Court cases that have begun to chip away at the affirmative action regime that we've been dealing with over the past, I don't know, I guess now 30-some-odd years. And there are ways in which universities are beginning to contemplate bringing about similar incomes without necessarily using race by focusing on geography, I mean, or social context. I mean, can you give me a sense of how those ideas dovetail with what you would do if you were providing, if you were in charge of admissions for universities?
Well, I would actually look at the Posse Foundation approach rather than what you described. And the Posse Foundation is basically looking for people who work together well to solve problems and people who work together well to reassure each other that they are not only positioned but capable of making contributions. And so it's a foundation that recruits people who are interested in going to institutions of higher education, and it encourages them to see themselves as part of a quote-unquote posse, meaning a group of people that may have different perspectives on the world, may have different life experiences, may have different gifts. But it's the group that can work together to solve problems that the Posse Foundation is not only identifying, but then reinforcing and reassuring as they go through college. And many of those students, many of those Posse participants go on from graduation to do wonderful things, including there are a couple of people, Shirley Collado is one of them, who was one of the first people in the Posse program, and she's now in a high position at Rutgers University. So the point is that we in the United States have a weakness for the testocracy as a measure of merit, but we haven't really had an open conversation about what it is that we mean by merit. And that's where the notion that merit is not simply a badge. It's really an incentive system that rewards actions a society values. That's a quote.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think you're quoting Amartya Sen, who is an economist at Harvard. And that's really ultimately, I think, the essence of what needs to happen is the recognition that merit is, like you say, is not so much a badge as it is a reflection of society's values. And I guess,
right.
I mean, give me your sense of where we are in that conversation. Have we not had it, or has it just been had by people behind closed doors and their assessment of what society values may be different than a lot of others?
No, I don't think things are over. I think there's an opportunity to have a larger conversation that's more democratic and more focused on collaborative problem solving rather than competitive test taking.
And I mean, but I'm trying to get at this notion of like how you think this system developed as opposed to one in which you would.
You mean how the current system?
Indeed.
Okay. Well, the current system reflects a pattern in higher education, which is a pattern that focuses on individuals who come from upper middle class or wealthy families and are in a position, therefore, not only to pay the tuition at these schools, but to ultimately contribute back to the schools as alumni. And so there's a sense that higher education is unfortunately not funded as much as it could be by the democracy, by the government. And compare, for example, Canada and the way it attracts students to institutions of higher education and its commitment to educating students who had over an 80% average in high school without regard to what high school they went to. So I think the issue at its core has to do with what do we think a real democracy means, and what would it take in terms of constituting the people who would contribute to that democracy? What would it take to understand or to identify who those people are? Right now, we've been overtaken by a preoccupation with, or I shouldn't say a preoccupation, but a sense of connection or an understanding of the importance of subsidizing institutions of higher education by identifying wealthy people who can contribute to it, and compare that to a place like Sweden or Finland or Canada, where institutions of higher education, as well as institutions of K through 12, are considered institutions that deserve the support of the government, not just that have to recruit the people in the society who have the most amount of money and therefore in a position to subsidize the institution of higher education.
I mean, hasn't that always been the case, at least in this country? I mean, isn't that on some level how the system is designed? Because at that point, you look upon wealthy benefactors to fund your university, and you need to bring to them some type of data that suggests they're funding a top university, because that makes them more inclined to give money. And you also want to make sure that measure, which designates you as a top university, rewards people who are like that person you're looking for money from.
There was a very intriguing article in the Harvard Crimson about 6 years ago, and the title was basically "Show Him the Money." And what struck me, this was an issue of the Crimson that was right around graduation, and it was identifying the prospects for the men who graduated from Harvard and comparing that to the women who were graduating from Harvard. And the thing that struck me that really in many ways confirms what you're saying is that the men who were interviewed, and they did a pretty good job of capturing a record number of students, record meaning a fair amount of students to reflect on what was happening among the graduates as a whole. And the point was that the men were going to Wall Street to make money, and the women wanted to work as educators or as doctors or something where they were contributing to the society. And the Crimson, that is the student newspaper, thought there was something wrong with the women, not something wrong with the men. In other words, why would the women settle for a job that wasn't going to make them a lot of money?
And of course, a university, may function like that perspective of the Crimson, right? Because we want to turn out people who are going to go to Wall Street, because they're going to turn around and endow the university.
Well, I think that's certainly one plausible argument. But I also think it's not just about endowing the university. It's also what kind of people are we educating, or what are we doing to educate people so that they feel a commitment to approach democracy and approach opportunity. They feel that that's part of the mission, not only of institutions of higher education, but a mission that they too should share, because we all benefit when we have people who can work together to solve problems, and those people are often better at solving the problems if they come from different perspectives, different backgrounds, and therefore are looking at the problem from with a different lens, and thus contributing to a more complex and yet a more appropriate or at least a more widespread contribution.
Who ultimately do you want to read this book? I mean, in terms of, I mean, who is it, you know, I guess, I mean, obviously you want as many people as possible, but if you had to choose, what subset of people would you want to read and this book and get this message?
Well, I'm open to any group of people reading the book, because I'm not claiming that I'm in a position to make judgments, and I welcome the criticism and I welcome the contribution of people who disagree with me. This what I'm hoping that we have is a conversation. I'm not suggesting that I have all the answers, but I am suggesting that we need to have a different approach, a different sense of what merit is, and a willingness to collaborate to solve the complex problems that we as a society face in the next generation of our members.
Professor Lonnie Guinier, the book is The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Good luck with the snow.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks. I mean, this topic, I think, is fascinating to me. I mean, particularly around this notion of how we measure merit. And I didn't realize it, but you know, her book raises the fact that the meritocracy, maybe I did and I had just forgotten it, but I'm trying to find my notes here on this, but the term meritocracy came from a 1958 book, a British book that was actually like a satire. And the idea was that, it was Michael Young. And he had written a book, The Rise of the Meritocracy, 1870 to 2033. And, you know, the notion of the meritocracy that we supposedly live under in this country, I mean, I think in many respects people realize is a bit of a joke. But the idea is that you set up a system which rewards a certain group of people, and you pretend the system is completely objective, based upon standards that everybody would agree upon, and that this is a methodology in which you can determine the relative value of people in society, and that is, and those people get those rewards. I mean, that is the ultimate sort of libertarian perspective, right? If you can afford health insurance, you deserve it. If you can't afford health insurance, you don't deserve it. And that's the way that we have determined your merit in society. And so, I mean, at one point, I was telling Michael that back in my early days of stand-up, the early 90s up in Harvard Square, actually.
That's pretty ironic, dude.
Yes.
Joking about the corruption of the meritocracy in the heart of it.
Yes. I was not. I love to tell people that I was up there at that time because, oh, did you go to Harvard? No, I worked at Bartley's Burgers, actually. Well, I was the reason why they had an endless cup of coffee. Mr. B and I don't know if Mr. B is still alive. The whole restaurant was run by, like, there was at least three sons. One son they kept in the basement peeling potatoes, and he just liked to listen to jazz. I'm not kidding. And he was the guy that I related to because he obviously was the son who was not sort of as directed, right? They just had him down there. He was literally peeling potatoes, listening to jazz all the time. There were two other sons upstairs. The mom worked upstairs and at least two of the daughters. And there, I think there was like another half dozen Bartleys. And they would have these big family fights. And I, of course, couldn't help but inject myself into the fights. And Mr. B liked me because apparently Lenny Clark had worked there before I had, who was another Boston comedian. And he sort of liked me. And at one point, like, he had put up – this is – I'm getting, like, thrice removed here. But at one point, he had put up an article from – I think it was, like, the Cambridge Gazette or whatever it was, saying – people in Harvard Square, workers in Harvard Square, are excited to have their jobs because it was like 1991, I think, at the time there was a recession because of the recession. And so the next day I put up a sign underneath it based upon the recession and the struggles, the dynamic between workers and employers in Harvard Square. There is talk afoot to unionize all waitstaff. And one of the Bartley's sons got very upset about that. And so when I took like a 2-week vacation or 3-week vacation to travel, they made me reapply for my job, and I refused to do it. Like literally, it was like, what's your job history? And I'm like, my job history was here.
Dude, you'll be in the basement friggin' carving like russet potatoes and listening to Louis Armstrong with a loser son.
But I was the one who told Mr. B, I said, dude, just give everybody a bottomless cup of coffee and raise the price by a dime on the first cup, because people don't care that you only charge them 45 cents. They get pissed when you charge them another 45 cents for whatever the second coffee was. Anyways, the point is that this bit I did was about the arbitrariness or not arbitrariness of our meritocracy. And I think I was saying, like, if I was in, you know, if you allowed the guys I hung out with in Worcester to set up the meritocracy, it would all be based on how many Busch beers you can consume on any given evening in the parking lot in front of the Friendlies. And then maybe you would also cross-reference that with how many of those losers you could beat up from St. John's. And
let's look at rival your scores. You got 15 Busch beers. Now, how much food intake is there?
No, it was just like,
grade this on a curve.
With that said, you did drive here in Innova, so and you had 3 aluminum bats in your trunk.
So on balance, that's 90th percentile.
Aside from the fact that I remember walking off the stage and another comedian going, dude, why don't you tell any jokes up there? You're funny. How come you keep going up there and insisting on not telling any jokes? And so, but that idea that we have this, and I think maybe we are at a period in our history where the people would be more open to that conversation and think about, like, well, you know, how is it that we determine merit? Because I think there's a far greater awareness of the implications of test taking. And, you know, I went to Kaplan Prep, Stanley Kaplan Prep. I remember going after school for my SATs. And I think I did the same thing for the LSATs. And I aced them. And you know, I don't know how much it cost because I probably didn't even pay it. It was probably my folks. You know, that was the trade-off. And even if, you know, we found with Mila, we started getting, you know, in New York, they have these gifted and talented sort of separate schools inside of schools at the public schools. And we started her taking these tests very early just because we knew that we weren't going to send her anyways. And we wanted to just get her prepared for testing and to do it in a way that's like, you know, show her we don't really care. This is just something fun to do. And so she's not intimidated by taking tests. But we found it would definitely, year over year, impact her test score depending on how much we would sit down with her and do practice tests. And, you know, we had the ability to do that at times because Nikki wasn't working and, you know, we could afford to not have Nikki work at different times. So, I mean, this is all that's aside from the fact that the test itself, you know, you may have a benefit if you're able to take your kid to travel.
Of course.
You know, you know.
Just a moment of Bates pride here. Because Bates was one of the first schools.
Bates.
Yeah, which is ranked higher than Khan College, but whatever.
I don't think so, but go ahead.
I invite, let's IM on the in the second half. Everybody's free to look that up. But at any rate, Bates was one of the first, like, top schools to not require an SAT.
Yeah, not so much top school. Wow. And that's why it's not so top.
It's so
it doesn't
brutal
do the,
what you're saying to Khan
do the
College
SAT.
if you're insulting Bates, and Bates is ranked so much higher. I don't know why you diss yourself like that. But the thing was is they measured it, and there was, like, obviously no discernible performance because people could still submit, and it would help their applications if they wanted to submit a high score.
So both
but they measured, is there any actual performance difference in terms of actually being there and getting good grades?
Everybody was
no
equally
difference.
Low performing.
Everybody was equally above Connecticut College at Bates. That is correct.
Mm. Classic. Really classic. Boy, you did not
Connecticut
get
college.
Anything about what we just discussed.
The third college in Connecticut.
All right. We're going to take a break and head into the
I got it. Bates is
fun half of the
college.
Show. You know what? Actually, let me just read this email because if you haven't listened to the Johan Hari interview from, I guess it was a little more than a week ago, week and a half ago, I think it was January 22nd, we got a bunch of emails in response. We get a lot of emails in response to a lot of interviews, but this one we had a real lot, and obviously can't read all of them, but I wanted to read this one just because it's just an interesting perspective that differs in some respects with Johan's. I've been listening to the interview with Johan Hari over and over again. As someone whose father, sister, and close friends have all at some point been addicted to opiates and alcohol, I've got to say in some ways it's a little hard to hear. There were some things I took issue with, like the notion that opiate users don't generally harm people. And I should tell you folks that I'm slightly editing this for time. I guess if we're talking physical harm, that much is probably true. But watching family and friends destroy themselves certainly hurt me emotionally. I was most consumed in this destruction during my high school years, and I felt alien to the world around me. I couldn't even keep a spare change jar in my own room. I didn't feel comfortable reaching out to anyone, and for the most part, I neglected things like grades while I began to act out in other ways, stealing and vandalism. The day after graduation ceremonies, I chose to be homeless rather than live in the house I grew up in. I had to attend summer school to get my diploma, which meant sleeping in the school's baseball fields. It's hard to exactly measure collateral damage from drug addiction, and my experience is so subjective, I can't imagine ever developing a quantifiable way to measure aftermath. I guess saying these drug addicts generally don't harm people is accurate, but it's not entirely the full story. And then he goes on to talk about the idea that if we decriminalize, that the price will go down, and that in his experience, that has not necessarily impacted people's desire for one drug over another. They just get as much as they can. Eventually, and especially with addicts, the well runs dry, and they have to choose the cheapest choice. So why would an addict choose to spend more for a pill that doesn't seem to hit as hard? I think the idea is that he actually gets to it in this. I've always been a little apprehensive about drug law reformation because of my personal experiences. So here's why I think most of my qualms are quelled. Because the progressive position, and this is where he makes a distinction between the progressive position on legalizing drugs, decriminalizing drugs, and the libertarian one. And this is a very important distinction. Because the progressive position doesn't just end at decriminalization. This is why I also think that you disagree with the libertarian position about anti-drug laws. I've had brief debates myself with free market enthusiasts and radical capitalists who declare that simply decriminalizing every substance would effectively solve our problems, rarely, if ever, providing how and whys regarding the social aspects. Libertarians don't see, or logically shouldn't see, the government setting up and providing funding for the well-being of addicts as either necessary or just, and that just isn't practical. And so I think if you ever debate someone on this topic, that would be a great way to prove the difference. I mean, the point that he's making here is that when liberals talk about decriminalization, they're not just simply about talking about we're going to decriminalize and walk away from it. It is looking upon addiction as a public health issue wherein the government has a significant role to play in mitigating the impact and in helping those addicts in a way that the libertarian position necessarily doesn't. It speaks to me that this position is humane, respectful, and pragmatic about the subject. Proud to be a Dewsbane member of the show. It challenged me on such a personal level. Keep up the good work, good work, guys. Very gratifying email, and such a good point. Great point.
That's such really an obvious point. Distinction.
It's such no an obvious that... distinction. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. If you want to be a part of the program, oh, don't forget the app. Our app is completely free. You can listen to the show live. You can IM us. You can call us. And you can obviously download or stream the podcast. And it's searchable. So pick up the app today at majorityapp.com. We're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Like I say, you can IM me at majorityfm via your instant messaging client. Or you can just use the app. We're going to probably do a random rush today. 646-257-3920. Oh, we got some wonderful Rand Paul sound. Rand Paul's a doctor. Am I right on that? Or is this his father?
He is some sort of doctor.
He's a doctor, too, of some sort, yeah.
The idea.
He's self-accredited somehow.
Even Dr. Ben Carson, who, like I say, sounds like a great brain surgeon, which shows you that just because you're a brain surgeon doesn't mean you know what you're talking about in other areas. But when it comes to medicine, at least, he has had, I guess, too much invested in being a doctor to say anything other than people should get vaccinated or vaccinate their kids. All right, we're going to take a quick break.
Oh, Rand Paul was an eye doctor.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, all about me. More like a me doctor, am I right? All right, we'll be right back after this.